We are talking today with Doug Henwood, who is editor of the Left Business Observer, regular contributor to The Nation magazine, and author of his new book, After the New Economy. Doug, thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
Let me start out, and before we get into your book, ask you a little bit about the Left Business Observer. What is that, and how long have you been working on that?
It's a newsletter I started in 1986. It looks at economics, politics, finance, all those things rather broadly defined. I aspire to get it out monthly. I don't always quite make it, but it's an 8-page newsletter that covers the world of money and its dissatisfactions. If people want to check it out, there's a website, leftbusinessobserver.com, which will have sample articles and more information and a little bragging as well.
And your new book, After the New Economy, start out and tell us what the motivation is in writing this book.
Well, I started it during the high point of the new economy, around 1999, and I was thought that this was an episode of madness that would come to no good end. Unfortunately, I don't write quickly enough, and the new economy expired before I finished the book, so I had to change some of the verb tenses as I finally got to finish it. But the hook is looking at that period, looking at the boom, what it was all about, what happened. But then it really is kind of an excuse to look at American economic history over the last 10, 20 years, what's been going on, and then to a lesser extent the rest of the world. There's a chapter on globalization that explores, you know, what that all means, and believe me, it's not easy to define. But it's an attempt to look at the era of, say, like hypercapitalism that began in the late 70s, early 80s, associated with the names Reagan and Thatcher and Volcker, and to look at the promises, the performance, and the ideology and the dissatisfactions of this period of very intensified competition and polarization of wealth and incomes, which has brought us to a situation we haven't seen in this country since the early 1930s in terms of polarization.
Was that the period of time in the late 70s, 80s when we saw some serious efforts towards privatization? Was that a key part of that economy?
Yeah, it's what people outside the U.S. call the era of neoliberalism. Some people call it that here, but the term is much more popular in Europe and Latin America. It means privatization, deregulation, erosion of the welfare state, attacks on unions, really an intensified competition. We're all supposed to be separate individual economic units in constant competition with each other. Any notions of social solidarity are out the window. The famous quote from Margaret Thatcher, there's no such thing as society, there's only individuals and their families. That's the ethic of the era. The current administration, the Bush administration, doesn't really seem as obsessed with economics as some of its predecessors did, certainly as much as Reagan and Clinton were obsessed with it. They seem much more excited about foreign adventures. But still, this era of privatization and competition is alive and well, and the Bush administration's, I think, special contribution is accelerated subsidies towards very rich people through the forms of tax cuts or procurement contracts for Halliburton in Iraq. It's a very naked form of public subsidy of private wealth.
So this bloom, this high point in 1999, how much truth is there to that?
Well, the boom of the late 90s had some good aspects to it. Certainly, it brought poverty rates down. There were across-the-board income gains in the second part of the decade, which was a reversal of the previous 20 to 25 years when just rich people were doing well and everyone else was either stagnant or in declining incomes. But I think that was, now it looks in retrospect, like the good byproduct of an unsustainable bubble. And it was clear the American economy was running on fantasy and a lot of borrowed money. Some of it trickled down for the last few years of the 90s, but now we look at it, it's all busted, and we've had this extended period of recession, stagnation, and very weak recovery. And I think we're not going to see anything like that boom anytime soon. So I think we need to look at a lot of more structural aspects of the American economy, why it generates these alternating booms and busts, but also why it generates so many low-wage jobs, so much insecurity, so much wealth for people at the top, but for everyone else, it generates a lot of alienation and stress. Business Week magazine, which was one of the major promoters of the boom in the late 90s, did a poll, I think around 1999, asking people, first of all, if they'd heard of the productivity revolution. Most people had. But then they asked if people had felt any benefits from it, and most people said they hadn't. So it was this period when we're supposedly having this wonderfully beneficent economic revolution that, for most people, was barely different from the periods that had gone before when there was no revolution happening. It just didn't feel as good as the hypesters were saying it should.
And based on their definitions, are we still in the productivity revolution, or is that already over, or what?
No, it looks like it's still going on, according to the official statistics. And we saw that, for example, in the statistics that came out in the third quarter of this year, we had, on the one hand, GDP growth of 7.2%, which is not the the biggest quarter we've ever had, but certainly it's in the top 20% of quarters we've had. And at the same time, there is barely any growth in employment. So this is a very strange world where you can have really, really strong economic growth, but for most people, it feels a little different from recession. And now we've also seen at the same time, we had pretty good wage gains, as I said, in the late 90s and into the early part of the aughts. But now those wage gains have disappeared, and wages are barely keeping up with inflation. So we're back where we were in the 80s and early 90s again with stagnant wages. But from the point of view of the hypesters and certainly from the point of view of stockholders and managers, this is a pretty nice situation. They're getting good economic growth numbers. At the same time, they don't have to pay people or hire people. That's a very nice situation if you're on top. It's not so good if you're not.
One of the economic indicators that, of course, they like to throw at us on the news every night and use as the teaser is constantly the stock market, and it looks like it's coming back a little bit. Can you go into whether the stock market is really a real indicator that affects us regular people?
The stock market is a complicated thing. It sort of is connected to the real economy, and it isn't. It has a way of going off on its own sometimes, but it also reflects developments in the real economy. So it's hard to specify in a few phrases just what its connection to the real world is. But I would say that one of the real stories of the last 20 years has been the great bull market in stocks that we saw between 1982 and the top in 2000. The fundamental cause of that, the underlying cause of it, was the increase in corporate profitability that happened starting around 1982 and extending into the late 90s. And how was that accomplished? It was accomplished by choking back on wages, by breaking unions, by cutting back on the welfare state, by making people work harder without paying them more for it. So it was really an intensification of work and speed up. And anybody who's employed, I'm sure these are all familiar things. People feel it in their jobs every day. But the stock market then was reflecting that increase in profitability. The stock market is also very influenced by psychology and sentiment. And for people on the top of the income distribution, things were very, very good. They were very happy about it. You know, politics was going their way. The economy is going their way. They were getting richer and richer. And then in the late 80s, their great enemy, the Soviet Union, collapsed. And so there was absolutely no alternative to American-style hypercapitalism anywhere on Earth. So you can understand why they were very happy and why the stock market really got going. And then around the mid-90s is when the public started getting involved, which was just as the trend was maturing, you know, and all these developments were starting to go to seed. So, for example, the increase in corporate profit rates that started in 1982 topped out around 1997 and then fell after that, even though the stock market kept rising. And that's when you know, ordinary folks were getting involved. Middle-income people were getting involved, buying mutual funds. And you could walk into a bar, and instead of ESPN, you'd see CNBC on the TV. It really infected the whole culture. But it's very ironic that large numbers of people, ordinary working middle-class, upper-middle-class Americans, were cheering the stock market on when, in fact, that the bull market was really about a celebration of their own stagnant incomes and increasing insecurity. They were, like, getting crumbs out of this because, you know, maybe their small mutual fund portfolio is doing well. But in fact, the fundamental cause of that bull market that had gone on for 15 years earlier was the fact that their paychecks weren't growing and that they were working harder and not getting paid for it. And it was a great confidence trick, and not many people had figured that out.
Talk a bit about hypercapitalism. How is the U.S. economy different than the other economies, let's say like the U.K.'s economy?
Well, the U.K. economy is, of all the economies outside the U.S., the U.K. is probably the most similar to ours in that there's a very large financial sector. The stock market plays an important role in how corporations are owned and run. And the welfare state is pretty weak. Britain has a stronger welfare state than we do and much stronger unions than we do. But compared to continental Europe, it's got a lot in common with the United States. The continental European economies, however, they're very different. They have, for the most part, much lower poverty rates, much less polarized distributions of income. In a lot of ways, it's better to be unemployed in France than it is to be employed as a low-wage worker in the United States. You certainly have a more comfortable life materially, and certainly there are problems with not working. People get alienated, and there are social problems with being that detached from the world of work. But just in purely material terms, you can't fall as hard or as far in most of the continental European economies as you can in the United States. The kinds of rampant homelessness that we see and have gotten very used to in American cities just barely exists in a lot of Western European economies. And that's because they have still, despite all the economic reforms of the last 20 years, they still have a pretty active welfare state that takes money from richer people and gives it to poorer people. People twist themselves into knots trying to explain the maldistribution of income in the United States, but it really comes down to the fact that in other, I would say, more civilized economies, there is this welfare state that does make sure that if you're unemployed or disabled, you're not going to starve. We don't have such a thing here. The only way that you can have that kind of assurance is if you've got an active public sector that will take tax money and give it to poorer people. They also have very universal social programs. In the United States and to a lesser extent the other English-speaking countries, Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the public assistance programs are very targeted on poor people. Now, there's a superficial appeal to that. You know, you say, we don't want to waste money on people who don't deserve it. You just target the programs for the people who most need it. But in fact, that does two things. It creates a stigma for the programs themselves. As the saying goes, programs for the poor are poor programs. So we have, it's often humiliating and very, very poorly financed in this country. But also, there is a constituency among the broad population to retain the welfare state because everybody benefits from it. For example, there's almost no serious tax rebellions of any kind in Western Europe. And, you know, the Scandinavian countries, where people pay very high taxes, you would think that they would be up in arms about it. But, in fact, for the most part, they're not because they realize they get all this, you know, income support and they get free tuition, free health care. People in college in Sweden, for example, actually get a stipend equal to, I think, 2/3 of the average industrial wage. We in the United States pay relatively high taxes, and it's very hard to say what we get for it. But you know, I think people in the Western European countries see that they do get a lot for it, and they're not voting to limit taxes and do all the things that you see in this country. And also as a result of the universality of these benefits, you don't get the development of private insurance programs like you do in this country. So you know, everyone is involved in the same health care program. Everyone is involved in the same retirement pension scheme. So even in this area of, say, providing for retirement, we have a very competitive model. We're all supposed to provide for ourselves and run our own retirement portfolios, even though people are not capable of doing those things very well very often. So that kind of system promotes solidarity and security, while ours promotes insecurity and individualism and often ugly kind of competition.
Has ours always been that way, or was it just in the last 20, 40 years where it shifted to that?
It's mostly been that way. We certainly, during the New Deal and then again in the Great Society, the 60s, developed rudiments of a welfare state that didn't exist before. But these were always much less generous and much less universal than it was in other countries. And I think there are any number of reasons for it. First of all, this has been, you know, from the beginning, a country that revered the individual and self-sufficiency and self-reliance. We also, as a country that was formed by successive waves of immigration, and also the country with the heritage of slavery and a racial divide, it's been much more difficult to develop the kind of social solidarity and the politics that come from that than it was in other countries where people have a much more developed sense of class solidarity, class consciousness. That just doesn't really exist here very much. And so, for example, when Americans are poor or unemployed, they often blame themselves for their problems, something they're not doing right. They don't have a good resume or they don't have the right training, but they're not inclined to look at systemic reasons why these things happen or any kinds of broader collective solutions to the problem.
So that's the way we've been raised to a degree and institutionalized. Has that been driven by the people in power, the upper class?
Well, certainly, that's part of it. We're bombarded constantly with urgings to self-reliance. You just can't rely on anybody else. You just have to rely on yourself. And, of course, Reagan very successfully, when he uttered this phrase, government isn't the solution to the problem, government is the problem, a lot of people came to believe that. And, again, we saw that in Britain. Thatcher is also quite successful at spreading that around, although there was a much more profound working-class consciousness in British society than there ever has been here. Now, on the other hand, I would say that if you ask people very general questions, abstract questions, you know, do you believe in that the government should help? Or how would you describe yourself? You know, people will say, like, I'm a moderate or a conservative. But then you ask them very specific questions, and then things get a little different. For example, in polls, the idea of some kind of universal public health insurance program is actually far more popular than you would suspect. The idea of raising the minimum wage and indexing it to inflation is something that is broadly popular. So in that sense, I think the elite has managed to spread the labels and the ideology very successfully. But still, when you get down to the level of specifics, then the American public is a bit more social democratic than you might expect from just the way the public discourse is carried on.
Sticking with the concept of tools and things that are presented to us as citizens for how the economy is running, one of them being the stock market. One of the things they economists constantly say on the television is the GNP, GDP. They use that as the measure that we will explain this in. Are those really valid concepts in this day and age?
Well, they're useful to some degree. Certainly, in most cases, people are better off when GDP is growing more rapidly than when it's not. But it's a very abstract and aggregate measure, and it doesn't really tell you how it's distributed. So you can have growing GDP and flat or declining employment or wages. The income gains of the last 20 years have overwhelmingly been claimed by people in the top 20% of the income distribution. So that gives you a nice headline figure. Income is growing. GDP is growing, but in fact, poverty might be growing as well. We had that during the 80s. We had declining average incomes at the same time the GDP was growing. We had that in the early 90s. And like I said before, in the late 90s, things were a little more equitably distributed, but there's no direct relation between how well the GDP is growing and how well off actual people are. Often they can be the same, and often they can be going in opposite directions. And the kinds of measures of actual human welfare receive a lot less attention than all those big headline numbers do. You know, for example, the Census Bureau releases its annual estimates of income and poverty in the fall of every year. It gets, you know, one day's notice when it comes out. You know, poverty rose X number of points last year, poverty fell X number of points last year. And then you never hear about it again until it comes out the next year. So those kinds of human indicators are given much less emphasis than the kinds of headline numbers that people on Wall Street like to pay attention to.
Well, and we just had our poverty indicators come out. What was your take on the numbers this year?
Well, poverty rose and incomes fell. That's pretty much what you expect in a recessionary period. Again, like I said, you get one day's notice of this and then it goes on. But in fact, we have an extremely high poverty rate in this country for it was supposed to be a very rich society. And the official definition of poverty is actually a pretty stingy one. The concept of a poverty line was developed in the United States in the early 1960s and was based on 1950s spending patterns. And they just fixed a poverty line, I think, in 1964 or 65, and have only adjusted it for inflation ever since. So conceptually, a poverty-level income in 1965 is the same as a poverty-level income today, even though average incomes have grown substantially. And the poverty line, you know, relative to people at the middle income distribution keeps sinking. So even though we have this very, I think, flawed definition of poverty, the numbers remain very high. We have as many people, or the same percentage of the population, roughly below this poverty line as were in 1979, even though we've had the GDP has grown two or three times over that same period. People who study income and poverty, as academics who study it, usually use a poverty line that is relative to average incomes. So a very common measure in the income and poverty world is poverty line would be half the average income. If you were below that, then you were poor. By that measure, we'd have a poverty rate in this country of 20% or higher, not the 12 or 13 or 14 that it generally hovers around most years. And you know, that's really scandalous. You know, 20% of a population in a country that in many ways is the richest that the world has ever seen. It's really criminal, but nobody really talks about it. It's just sort of accepted as a fact of life.
Talk a bit more about the income polarization. You've brushed upon that. And give us a comparison with how here in the U.S. we line up against other Western countries.
Yeah, well, there are two, crucial myths about America that almost universally believed. One is that everybody is middle class. We're not a class stratified society. This is, you know, universally middle class country. And two, that we have a great deal of upward mobility. So if you're born poor, you can still, you know, get rich or become president or whatever. No. Bill Clinton was born poor and became president, but that's not really a very representative biography in this country. Most people stay very close to the income category they were born into. People will move a notch up or a notch down, but there's nowhere near the kind of extended mobility that most people think. And also that our society is not really any more mobile than those of old Europe, even though we think of those as very class stratified societies. In fact, Germany and Sweden show the same kind of mobility roughly as we do in this country. And one of the reasons that's important is that people apologize for the high levels of poverty in this country by pointing to that mobility. Because, you know, so they say, well, you know, you may start poor, but then you can pull yourself up by your own bootstraps and you won't stay poor forever. the poverty rate is just a snapshot of any one given moment, so people may be poor for a year or two and then get out of it. But in fact, that's really not typical. People are very often stay poor or near poor for their whole lives. And the other part of the myth, that we're universally middle class, is also really not supported by comparative statistics. We have, just in income terms, the smallest middle income class of the major industrial countries. We have the close to the highest number of rich people, and by far the highest number of poor people. So we have, even though we think of this as the universally middle-class country, we actually have a comparatively small middle class compared to the welfare states of Western Europe. And that is probably exactly the opposite of what most Americans believe, but that is what's supported by the statistics, which I do cover pretty extensively in the book. So if anybody's skeptical, they can go look it up.
Talking with Doug Henwood, author of After the New Economy. That's a fact that doesn't seem to make it much on the evening news.
No, it certainly doesn't. I think, Americans in a lot of ways are quite provincial. They don't hear very much about what goes on in the outside world. They just assume that we're better off than everybody else, and everybody else envies us for it. And in fact, that certainly is not borne out by, at least by the income distribution measures internationally. Rush Limbaugh, I think, famously said that poor people in the United States are better off than the middle-income people in Western Europe. And that is utterly delusional, I think. But that's the kind of thing that people on the political right say all the time, and they never get challenged. And you know, certainly our press, our media, are not very quick to dig up facts like this. They're out there. Anybody can find them. One of the paradoxes of American life is that there's so much information out there. We know exactly how many poor people there are. We know exactly how, well, not exactly, but we've got a pretty good idea. We've got a very good idea of how income is distributed. There's just all kinds of information out there, but it doesn't really matter. It doesn't really have that much influence on politics and public discourse. There's an old Edgar Allan Poe story, The Purloined Letter, in which the punchline is, the best place to hide something is in the open. And I think that's true of a lot of American life. You know, there's so much that's out in the open, but it doesn't seem to matter. You know, people just shrug their shoulders and move on to whatever, or they don't even pay any attention to it at all. It's very easy to get a hold of this information. You can find it out if you're interested, but people in the mainstream media, people in politics, pundits don't really like to talk about it.
Tell me, in your new book, After the New Economy, what else have you discovered in your work that the media is not covering here?
Well, there's a chapter in globalization in there, which is an examination of this strange word that people talk about all the time. I think there's a tendency to treat this thing as this kind of external compulsion that makes things happen. That actually, it's not very helpful. I don't think the word is very useful. And it's interesting, there's a chart in the book of how often the word appeared in major newspapers over the last 20 years. And it really hardly appeared at all until the early 90s, and then around 1995 just took off in a vertical ascent. The word globalization suddenly started appearing all the time. It's not really easy to say precisely what the word means. Capitalist economies have been internationalized for like 700 or 800 years. 19th century American development was financed in large part by capital coming in from London. We had extensive of trade between the U.S. and the outside world forever. But there's this sense somehow that there's this novelty of globalization which requires that people work harder for less, that government be cut back, that all kinds of bad things be excused because of these external pressures. And I think there's a great deal of exaggeration about this, that an awful lot of our economic problems are homegrown. Our labor law, for example, which makes it nearly impossible to organize unions, is just a purely domestic invention. If you compare income distribution in countries around the world, there's just no relation at all between the level of trade penetration in the economy and whether they're relatively equal or unequal countries. Most of the countries of Western Europe, for example, have higher levels of trade than we do, but also more equal distributions of income. South Korea has a surprisingly relatively equal distribution of income, but it's a very, very internationalized country. Brazil, which is one of the most unequal countries in the world, has a relatively low level of trade with the outside world. So there's a tendency, I think, to blame globalization for lots of bad things, but in fact, domestic politics and domestic institutions are the major causes of a lot of these things. And I think it's convenient for a lot of people to blame outside forces. It's very much easier for CEOs to blame foreign competition for why they have to lay off 50,000 people, even though it's actually the stockholders that really want them to do it. Or it's very easy for politicians to talk about global pressures, so they have to cut back on welfare state kinds of spending, when in fact it's really just domestic employers that want to see a less generous welfare state because it makes people work harder. So it's a convenient excuse, and there's a term in biology, a wastebasket taxon, which is a category that you put species into that you can't really figure out where they belong. So, this is the wastebasket taxon. It's just the category you apply to something you can't figure out how to categorize. And I think to a great extent that the globalization serves that purpose. You know, when there are bad things that happen, people can't or don't want to explain them. They just blame globalization when, in fact, causes may be much more complex and closer to home than that.
What other domestic institutions would you see besides the very corporations themselves as making the situation bad, like you just said?
Well, the corporations and their relations with Wall Street investors. That's one very important influence. And the constant downsizings we've seen for the last 20 years, even at good times, were in many cases coming from Wall Street pressure. Wall Street wants high and rising profits in good times and bad. And I remember the early 90s, it became very fashionable for CEOs to come into work one morning, announce 50,000 layoffs, and that adds 5 points to the stock price. So other CEOs say, oh, I can do that too. And since their compensation is tied to the stock price, they have a very direct material interest in that. The other institutions, I would also say, are unions or the lack of them that have a lot to do with wage levels. And unions are especially important to people who are not in demographically privileged groups. Unionized workers who are female or not white are much better off than non-unionized workers who are non-male, non-white. So they can help correct for a lot of discrimination that goes on in labor markets. And we have this enormous low-wage sector in this country. We have the largest low-wage sector of any major economy, and actually the lowest rate of exit from the low-wage sector. A lot of people who work poorly paying retail jobs, for example, will for their entire work lives work poorly paying retail jobs. And that unions would be very useful. There's a bit in the book where I talk about McKinsey, the consulting firm, did a study of the productivity revolution in 8 or 10 very specific industries to see what it really meant. And the star of the thing emerged as Walmart. Walmart was the star of the productivity revolution. And let's look at what that means. Walmart is a company that pays extremely low wages, is just a systematic discriminator against women, and uses technology to orchestrate a real hierarchy of exploitation around the world, from someone who's folding pants in a store in Texas to the person in China who makes those pants. This is the productivity revolution's, this is what it really means, is Walmart. And Walmart is also a brutally anti-union company. Any attempt to unionize is met with litigation, firings. They'll close divisions rather than face any kind of union threat there. So, these are the kinds of domestic institutions I'm talking about. And our labor law in this country also makes it extremely difficult to organize unions. We have really about the most anti-labor set of laws in this country of any major economy in the world. I think apartheid South Africa used to have worse labor law than we did, but that was it. And I think now that apartheid has passed, I think now the United States probably has the most anti-labor set of laws in the world. And the Bush administration, and particularly the judges that he has been appointing and would like to appoint in the future, would like to make it even more anti-labor. Their ideal is bringing us back to the 19th century, when the state was tiny and unions didn't exist, and anybody who tried to organize a union got shot. I don't know if they're going to bring back the days of Henry Clay Frick. I think it was Frick who said, "I can always hire half the working class to kill the other half of the working class." We may not literally be going back to that point, but I think that's the spirit that they're trying to get back to. So it's an ugly situation, and all this is homegrown. This is not the result of foreign competition. This is the result of the preferences of American politicians and American employers.
All right. Any last words or thoughts you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I would say that economics has succeeded in erecting a great barrier of mystification around itself. Most people think that it's just too hard to understand, too complicated, best left to experts. And, of course, economists and policymakers are very pleased to have it that way. And if we look back at the late 19th century, the American populist movement of that period was characterized by extensive popular education about how the economy worked, how monetary systems worked. There were study groups and magazines and books published which tried to demystify the world of economics and make it into a broad political issue that everyone could understand. And I think that's quite possible now. The economics profession itself is, or at least the stuff they publish in their journals, is extremely obscure. You know, it's filled with mathematics and obscure jargon. A lot of it is useless and irrelevant. I think the fundamental issues, though, of as Margaret Atwood once defined politics, who does what to whom and gets away with it, these kinds of really fundamental issues are certainly quite understandable by ordinary people. And also, I think there's no reason that these can't be discussed in a complex and mature way in public. But that's not the way our political system works, and it's not the way the media and the general public discourse works. It's just it deals in caricature and superficiality and doesn't often get below the surface either in just in terms of information or in analysis. And that's very sad. I think it could be a much more popular political topic than it is. And I just hope that my contribution, my books and my newsletter are trying to promote the goal of making this into something that everyone can understand and talk about knowledgeably. It's not quantum physics. The fundamental principles are intelligible to anyone, and just doesn't deserve the veil of expertise that it hides behind.
All right. Well, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.